welcome again to the official Cyblogs podcast. I'm Elf.
I'm Amy.
And today we have our usual strange and sultry collection of, I like to use a different word each week, science articles from across the globe, with particular reference to Cyblogs. So without further blather from me, let's just jump into it.
Indeed. Elf, what have you got? I believe you're beginning today.
Yes, today's first article is just a wee bit of national pride that's been floating around on interwebs for the past week. And that was because a New Zealander by the name of Rolf Olsen was the first amateur astronomer to capture a planetary disk of material surrounding an adjacent star. The star in question is called Beta Pictoris, and the reason he's the first amateur astronomer to do it is because all professional astronomers thought it was impossible. So good stuff there, Rolf.
Indeed. But it turned out not to have been, and in fact even Rolf was discouraged by a paper he read that was published a few years ago saying this sort of thing wasn't impossible. But how did he do it off? Want to fill us in?
Yeah, he actually used a pretty common technique. Well, it's common to professional astronomers, not so much to amateurs. Essentially, what he did, the problem with photographing a planetary disk is that it's very, very dim, especially when it's right next to a really bright star like Beta Pictoris, which is the star this one is around. So what Rolf did is he took a photographic image of the star, and then he took another photographic image of where he thought something might be around the star. And instead of just overlaying one over the other, he actually subtracted the two away from each other, and he looked at the difference between them. And so because the focus was, wasn't so different for the star in between the two images, most of the light and the background from the star actually got bled out of the resultant photograph. And what you see is this gorgeous little smudge of what is protoplanetary material from an amateur astronomer.
So yeah, good for him. I mean, it certainly takes a lot of patience. It apparently took him a few hours over a few days to process the image, but it's been the cause of sort of international news and joy.
Absolutely, it's fantastic. The star itself is a little over 60 light years away, so it's very close in the cosmic term of things, which is the only reason an amateur astronomer could have found it. But just good on him for doing it. That's awesome.
Yeah. But also, and we'll be talking about this more in various ways over the podcast, the way that increasingly good technology is enabling people to get back involved in science and scientific discoveries without needing, you know, the huge education, 10 years for a PhD, and the millions of dollars worth of equipment that only a large institution could afford. More and more people can sort of be a part of it in a way that we saw at the beginning of the modern scientific age.
Indeed, and you can even get like people like Amy and I into science, which is really quite remarkable when you think about it.
So yeah, congratulations. Now the next one is more a sort of, this isn't so much pride as enormous amounts of facepalming and head-desking. I don't know if our listeners would have seen, but all over the international press this week erupted the story about, you know, they're alive, these giant insects that live in New Zealand. They're the biggest insects in the world. They're talking about wetas, of course, which are not newsworthy to anybody who lives in New Zealand, but which apparently the rest of the world didn't know anything about. Well, certainly according to the tenor of these articles. And what happened was an American, in fact, let me look up his name here. His surname is Moffat. I think he may be with the Smithsonian, but we'd have to check that out. He's certainly a researcher, Mark Moffat, in fact. There you go. He fed a carrot to a giant weta on a recent visit he made to Little Barrier Island. And the picture of this weta munching on the carrot, which I have to say is terribly cute, has made international news. And so with all the hoo-ha, New Zealand insect expert and self-confessed bugman Ruud Kleinpaster has said that, you know, it's actually just not that significant. Well, it's not as significant as everybody makes out. Although they are endangered on the islands on which they live, there are thousands of them. You can find them on Little Barrier Island and Motuora Island. And so, you know, great, but it seems that it needed to be an American who saw it for it to mean anything. He also points out that this wasn't, although weta punga, so these giant weta, are the heaviest insects in the world, and the heaviest one ever recorded was 72 grams. The 71 gram specimen that Moffat says he found was only 71. So just a cautionary tale there, I guess, for our listeners all over the world is yeah, beware, particularly when it comes to enormous findings of great new things. It's possible the locals already knew about it.
It doesn't mean that weirders aren't noteworthy, though.
Oh,
They can
no,
do some
they're...
incredible things,
Oh,
like
man.
being frozen in suspended animation and then reanimated again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're fantastic creatures. They remind me a lot, growing up in South Africa, we had something called a Parktown prawn, which also inspired fear in many people. It was a little bit smaller, though, but also sort of unusual and confined to very small geographical regions.
Okay. Also, speaking of weird and wacky creatures, Amy, I think you have something rather interesting for us again.
I do. So, again, talking about the citizen science and getting people to be involved in the scientific process, after the last few years, there's been a lot of sort of crowdsourced science happening, things like Galaxy Zoo. And what has been happening is that stereograms or sounds or pictures, for example, with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, are being produced at enormous rates, and scientists need help in going through these thousands or tens of thousands of images or whatever and classifying them. And in the Galaxy Zoo example, it's led to a number of new discoveries, such as the Green Pea Galaxies, for example, and Hannes Forvap, or Annes Forvap. It's great because it means anybody who wants to be involved can be involved. And there are a number of things like this. You now get Foldit, which is all about folding proteins. So there's been some big news about that recently. And it's spreading into a number of other different types of science as well, stuff around DNA. It's great. Now, the newest example of this is an initiative from Scientific American and Last.fm, the online streaming radio station people of all things, and it's called Whale FM. If you go to whale.fm, that's a good place to start. And it's just fantastic. What they've done is they've taken hundreds and hundreds of sound recordings of pilot whales and orca whales, or killer whales, as some people like to call them. Pilot whales and orcas are actually both types of dolphins, but yes. And they need help classifying them. It appears that the communication between these animals is quite complicated. There are hundreds of different sounds. But scientists, once again, need help sort of trying to, you know, categorize all these recordings that they've taken and try and match them into groups that make sense together. So what they've done is they've started Whale.fm, where you can go online, you get a recording, you can see the stereogram of it, so the shape the sound makes, which means it's great for people who are visual, people who, you know, sort of more auditorily inclined. And then you get a list of other sounds that it might or might not be like, and you choose the one that it is most like. And the idea is that if they get, you know, the results of lots and lots and lots of people put together, it'll iron out sort of, you know, any major errors and inconsistencies in terms of, you know, maybe somebody had a cold one day or one of the examples given is that some of the very high sounds are actually in frequencies that many adults battle to hear. And hopefully this will allow them to better understand how these whales are communicating. Of course, one of the big issues being that it is now thought that human communication and even just sort of boat traffic and ship traffic, for example, may be disrupting the communication of these other marine mammals.
Which is really sad,
it
considering
is.
How gorgeous their song is.
Absolutely.
And how long-lived the songs can be and how far traveled they used to be before we started polluting the oceans.
Yeah.
Extraneous noise.
Indeed, but certainly, and if you like whale song, you know, this is a brilliant way of a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon to sit down, be involved in science, and do something cool for the dolphins.
I love that we live in a society where you can tune into a radio station and listen to whales.
I know, right? So do go and check that out. I started playing with it earlier today and had to put it down before it became an obsession.
Fantastic. Okay, so somewhat of an obsession from mine was picked up by an award by the Science Journal, or the journal called Science, this week. What it is, it's called Open Source Physics. It's a project, and you can visit this for free. It's www.compadre.org/OSP. And this is an open source educational resource for physics. It takes you through a bunch of different visual representations of things like the phases of the moon, to orbits, to anything else you can imagine. And what they're doing is they're not only just putting together a bunch of open source resources for physics, is they're putting through tutorials and an actual curriculum to teach anyone that's interested for free all the principles that computational physics uses. And this stuff is just amazing. Now, I don't do much computational physics in my day-to-day work, but the little I do is based on Python, and I've used Tracker, which is a video analysis software in the past, and they use both of these to great effect. And this is just really cool to see that everyone can contribute to something like this, and everyone can learn from it as well, which is another big soapbox issue of mine that I just love to see that this is being made freely available. And the authors of the paper, their names are Wolfgang Christian, Francisco Esquivel, yeah, I pronounced that wrong, and Lyle Barbato, I have all won a prize called the Spore Prize. Now, it's not the Spore Computer Game Prize. It actually stands for Science Prize for Online Resources in Education. And it looks like this is a fantastic website with a whole bunch of different resources. So I'm really excited to see this and to see where it goes in the future. I've certainly learned a lot from it already.
Yeah, it sounds just amazing. And once again, you know, this sort of stuff's great for I mean, people, let's say, in the third world who have a difficulty of access to, you know, top-notch universities or schools. But also for people, let's say, who, you know, too young in school for their teachers to be covering that, or who've since left school and maybe don't have the time or the money or even the inclination to go back to university, but might still, you know, find that this really clicks with them and it's something they like knowing about and can potentially even be useful with.
Yeah, it's going to be very cool. I can promise you that.
awesome stuff. My next story carries on again on this idea of you know, groups and what people can do together if they sort of pool their resources and pool their knowledge. And this brings together two of my favorite subjects, which are gaming and cognitive neuroscience. Now, it sounds a bit weird than you think. Gaming often gets a bad rap from people. You know, they talk about, does it make our kids stupider? Does it make our kids more antisocial? Does it make our kids more violent? On and on and on this gets talked about. But there are also positive things that could be coming out of gaming. And this week's story is about a game called StarCraft II, which is a real-time strategy game. It's similar to StarCraft and Warcraft. All of those games our readers may have heard of. The idea basically is that you are a god-like being, and you are playing against another god-like being, another human generally. And you both start off very small with like a little base camp. Maybe you've got like a little mine, and you've got a couple of minions, and you can start mining for resources or gathering resources, maybe chopping down wood, whatever the case may be. That's more sort of Warcraft, but the same principle. And then as you accrue resources, you're able to do things like build factories which can make more people or can make starships or can make, you know, ways to wage war or all kinds of things. So you end up building a civilization that gets more and more sophisticated. Now, the whole idea is that this is a battle. So you're not building it to live in a peaceful society. You're building it so you can flatten the other guy. And generally, the quicker, the better. You don't generally know exactly what the other guy's up to. That's sort of hidden. And you'll, I mean, based on personal experience, the first you'll know of it is when one of his scouting parties twigs to you, and then you realize if you're up against a good player, you've probably got a few minutes before it's all over and messily so. Anyway, that's StarCraft. So for a long time now, it's been thought that humans are just naturally not terribly good at multitasking. It's not only men who crap at it, but women too. But what they're seeing with StarCraft players is that they're very good at multitasking, because they're generally looking at, they're watching their base and they're watching the activity there and people off gathering resources and people training people and, you know, stuff building things. But they'll generally have various parties involved in various battles all over the map. They could be in very, very different places on the map, so they've got to zoom around a lot. They've got to be keeping track of a number of different things. On top of this, they also have to have very good coordination, because they control each one of their fighters singly and tell each one of them what to do. And they could get up to relatively sizable armies, all of which are using different strategies depending on what type of like a little fighter they've got. All it just gets really, really involved. And the best players are capable of making sort of 5 to 6 actions per second, which is biblically fast. You can go online and actually see the fights as they happen among some of the top players, and the action moves almost too fast to track. And these guys are making decisions behind it. I mean, it's extraordinary. So with that background, cognitive neuroscientists have been like, ooh, this looks very, very, very interesting. What can we learn here? And They talk about, you know, chess being the Drosophila of cognitive science. So it's sort of, it's been a really good model, and for scientists to help to understand sort of thinking and cognition back, to think about all the chess machines that are being built or and have been built and so forth. StarCraft II, they reckon, might be the rhesus macaque, so even better as a model, because it's far more complex. So it's a lot more difficult to study, but could potentially be far more rewarding in terms of what it spits out. And what they've been able to do is they've been able to get the replay logs, and a replay log is basically every action that a player makes during the game is recorded by the computer on which they're playing. And or the system with which they're playing. And they've gotten thousands of these logs from players from all different levels. And the idea is to sit down and start to compare them all to see, you know, what is differentiating the top players from the bottom players. Obviously they're faster and better, but what is actually going on? Can they start to derive some sort of cognitive rules out of this, possibly hints for the rest of us? That would be nice, certainly, on how to be better multitaskers. And one of the big things is that it looks like some of the skills that are learned during games like this are transferable. So with chess, for example, the skills that you learn in chess are not generally transferable to other things, whereas some of the skills here, particularly around visual acuity behind the ability to make very fast decisions, look like they might actually be transferable. So there's also potentially in this ways to train people to deal with, for example, emergency situations, but be able to deal with them with a cool head and make the necessary decisions really quickly. We'll keep watching it. As always, this is ongoing, but superb to see that gaming is, you know, really, really contributing to science.
And at this point, we should probably also note that this is by far and away not the first instance that gaming and science have overlapped quite considerably.
Oh, yeah.
There are innumerable instances of this. The one that springs to my mind, because I'm really a desperate wannabe virologist rather than a physicist, is back in 2007, there was an epidemic outbreak in the online massive multiplayer game World of Warcraft, and the epidemic in question followed a lot of the attributes of a real world epidemic. So people came in to visit the afflicted people, and then they went away and they took the plague with them, and they had all of these consequences both in game, and then a bunch of researchers actually got on board with this and studied it and got a couple of papers in various big name journals. One of them was published in Science, I believe.
Wow.
And since then, they've suggested doing it again in a controlled manner to try and test out different responses in terms of a medical or a social response to the actual particular epidemic, and trying it out in game. Because, of course, it's completely unethical to try different responses like this and to test responses against each other in real life when real human lives are on the line. But something like World of Warcraft or Second Life, it can be a reasonable model of reality in order to get some general ideas going. Obviously, there are big problems because, you know, in these games, death is more of an inconvenience and less of a permanent thing, but it is definitely interesting, and I'm really looking forward to seeing some more research in this particular field, just so I can sit around and play games, I think.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Hooray for the gamers.
Absolutely. Speaking of challenges in learning things, one of our, so this is the first of our Cyblogs stories this week, our blogger Alison Campbell, who is author of Behind BioBlog, attended a first-year teaching biology conference at Victoria University of Wellington. And she notes the keynote speaker, a scientist by the name of Pauline Ross, who's at the School of Natural Sciences from the University of Western Sydney and has won a whole slew of different awards and certificates and whatnot. She basically boiled down teaching biology into the problems with it, boiled down to six key facts. And I'm just going to run through them quickly because as a biology student, I can certainly relate to some of these. And given the last few stories we were talking about, it'll be really interesting to see how these two will work together in the future. So first off, the big issue with biology is content. There's so much, and we're constantly discovering so much that textbooks are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think if they get too much bigger, they're going to collapse into something like a black hole that you have to carry about in your satchel with you all day. So the idea here is that perhaps instead of studying the basics all the time and getting every single aspect of the basics, that once you have a framework to learn, You start studying the most modern ideas, and that reinforces science as a kind of a knowledge base that's constantly in flux, rather than just huge screeds of facts and figures that you have to memorize, because that's not science.
I agree. When I was studying at university, one of the subjects I studied was organic chemistry, which is an absolutely enormous field. It packs out entire libraries just on its own. And we were being required to memorize this admittedly fantastic textbook, but huge textbook for an exam. It was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages long. And rather than testing for the most part, I mean, occasionally they did, but not often, our ability to think, you know, could we design experiments? Did we understand conceptually what was going on? We had to memorize 30 amino acids and their left and right conformations, because as a working scientist, you'd need to have that sort of thing memorized. I am being sarcastic at this point. Of course one would not. You'd be able to look it up. And it seemed completely the wrong way to do it. So you end up with a whole lot of people who are very good at sort of spitting back facts, but have never been taught how to think about stuff.
And that's the big second one in this list. It's process and context. It's how to gather facts and then turn them into a framework that you can use to predict the results of future experiments, rather than just collecting these huge piles of facts that are all completely independent and unrelated. So she also notes being able to put these in a framework is crucial. And then she talks about inquiry as well. And this is something I'm quite passionate about, because inquiry is just crucial. So you give the students something, some kind of framework to study or look at, and you let them figure out what the answer is by themselves, by designing experiments, by going out and doing research, by anything else. But here the idea is increasing engagement, and that promotes learning. The fourth thing is obvious, it's jargon, and removing as much jargon as possible. Obviously, in science, there are a list of jargon terms that you do have to memorize and learn, but personally, I find that that comes with doing these first three, by getting involved, by inquiring, and by planning and testing things out, and by listening to things like podcasts. That's the only way I've got around the jargon in my particular field, which I still struggle with. And the final two are assessment, which I'm not going to go into, and innovation. So, I mean, innovation seems to be everyone's keyword at the moment, but the key point here being a huge emphasis on the value and encouragement behind innovation, rather than just blindly regurgitating facts, questioning them, and thinking about new ways to test accepted facts.
And new ways and better ways to teach.
And go on,
I was
Abby.
going to say, and that's the same thing with assessment. Once again, coming back to this idea of let's test a student's ability to think as opposed to their ability to memorize large amounts of facts, because that seems like quite a shallow level of knowledge as opposed to the very deep and sort of hyperlinked level of knowledge that students now have access to, even through things like the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. And personally, as a student, that's not how I learned, but that's why I did. I'm a for the listeners that I don't know, I'm an appalling student. I probably should have said this at the first podcast. I've never been a good student throughout my years at university or at high school, because I have this complete inability to understand facts. I can understand frameworks, but not facts by themselves.
Which just seems like that the system would have failed you. I was able to memorize stuff, but I just felt a lot of the time it was kind of like, well, that's great, I've memorized it, and then 6 months later it's gone. Which seems like a terrible waste of time, really. I'm not sure.
That said, though, there are some facts which kind of fundamentally change the entire framework. And Amy, you found something this week which kind of leads into that.
Remind me.
The book,
Oh, it
sorry.
is the book. Sorry, I thought we were talking about that next yet, but I wasn't sure. Right, this is another post by Ken Parrott, who writes Open Parachute. And this is about a book called The Day We Found the Universe by Marcia Bartusiak. I'm hoping I.
Fantastic title. I love that. It's just gorgeous.
Gorgeous. I hope I pronounced that correctly, Marcia. So Ken does really, really good book reviews. They're always worth having a look at, because he just, you know, he does really think about it, and he sets down what he likes about it. But what the book does is it describes the work and the people and the stories who produced our modern day understanding of the universe. So less than a century even ago, it's not so long ago, we used to think that our galaxy, otherwise known as the Milky Way, was the entire universe, and we also thought that it was static. Nowadays, of course, we know better. We know that that the universe is well, he says infinitely bigger. I'm going to say not quite infinitely bigger, but very, very much bigger. It's got billions of galaxies in ours, and it's expanding, or at least certainly our current understanding of science says that our universe is expanding. And apparently one of the big illusions that the book shatters is the sort of the received wisdom, the received story of how all of this was the responsibility and happened through the work of Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble telescope is named. Of course, he obviously played a very key role, but there were, and this would be standard amongst science stories really, is there are always going to be a slew of other people involved and other stories and personalities and hiccups and fights and drama and politics and the whole shooting match involved in anything like this. So the book goes back and actually looks at our history, looks at the history quite a lot as well. For example, Marcia reveals that concepts of a larger universe go back a long way further than certainly I had realized. In fact, even the concept of a multiverse has gone back to even in the first century BC, really. The Roman poet and philosopher Lucretius argued against a finite universe. And then over the next, you know, centuries, really, and it helped get people done in by the Inquisition and burned at the stake. And there were these ideas that our little spot of life and heat and warmth here may not be the only one, that it's possible that there were countless other heavens or universes or however it was people wanted to put it out there too. Which is quite a lovely thing to think about. She also talks about people like Henrietta Leavitt, who discovered the means to measure the dimensions of the cosmos. This is during a time when women were allowed in astronomy, sort of in secondary roles as computers, which I think is ironic. They did the repetitive calculations and recording from plates, but they weren't allowed to observe. And she goes into a number of other wonderful stories as well, which are really, really worth looking into. I'm certainly wanting to read this book as a result. But I did want to, hoping we have the time, just read out a passage here. It's a description of Edwin Hubble, because I think it's amazing. Alf, do we have time for that?
Yeah, we definitely have time. This passage is completely worth it.
Cool. So she also seems to have been very good at describing her characters very colorfully and sort of like warts and all, which you want from a good biographer, sort of storyteller. And here is a description of Edwin Hubble. He was an odd bird, but certainly a handsome one. Friends called him an Adonis. I think he resembles the British actor Jeremy Irons. Raised in Missouri in a solid middle-class household, Hubble somewhere along the line yearned to be singular and distinct. Once he graduated from the University of Chicago, he went to Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar, where he completely reinvented himself. He adopted a British accent that he maintained for the rest of his life, dressed like a dandy, and began to add dubious credentials to his resume, like saying he once practiced law, which he never did. He married into a rich Los Angeles family and throughout his life seemed intent on erasing his Midwestern roots. His wife never met Hubble's mother or siblings. Hubble was not chums with his astronomy colleagues, but preferred to socialize with the actors and writers in nearby Hollywood. One astronomer called Hubble, often arrogant and standoffish, a stuffed shirt. Yet, while Hubble fibbed to his friends about his background, he was meticulously careful about his science. In fact, when he obtained the first evidence in early 1924 that the Andromeda Nebula was truly a distant galaxy, he held off an official report for almost a year. He first wanted to counter every possible argument against his find. Being caught in a scientific error was Hubble's greatest nightmare. And when he did finally release the data at that astronomy meeting on New Year's Day in 1925, after a lot of arm-twisting from his colleagues, he wasn't even there. He had someone else relay the findings. So yeah, a singular personality by the sounds of it.
And one that's very well captured by the author.
Mm, mm. So look out for that book.
Absolutely. Completely changed humanity's understanding of our universe and our place within it.
Mm.
Not the book, the discovery. But the book was good too.
Indeed.
So my next thing is somewhat tangentially related, and right now I can't remember the segue. But anyway, it's another post on SciBlogs by our blogger Michael Edmonds, who writes Molecular Matters. And he answers the question, why don't we have a cure for AIDS yet? And so at the moment, Michael notes that the number of people with AIDS is actually going up. Now, before people freak out, that's because the people with AIDS are actually surviving rather than dying, which is increasing not the incidence of the particular affliction, but rather the longevity of the people within it. And he mentions that he was reading an article about that, and he started to read the comments again and again and again. He gets conspiracy theories, basically saying that big pharmaceutical companies want people to survive with AIDS but not cure it, so that they can roll in their swimming pools full of money, like that cartoon duck, Scrooge McDuck. And he goes through and quite systematically notes the difficulties with actually treating HIV, which is the cause for AIDS, and goes some way to explaining why we don't have a cure for HIV yet. And we will go through that. But before we do, I'd just like to point out that while it sucks that we don't have a cure for AIDS or for HIV yet, what was, because AIDS was first identified in 1983, what was then a complete and utter death sentence, a very, very high mortality rate, is now a treatable condition. You can live a normal life. You do have to take heart therapy. So this is a combination antiretroviral drugs, and you have to be on those for your entire life, but you can sustain a normal life with HIV. And I think that in and of itself is worth a mention. Even though it's taken us a good 25 years or so to develop that particular technique, we have made huge strides in treating this disease.
Indeed. I recently, I don't have a citation for this. I'll try and look one up for the blog post that comes with this podcast. But I saw somewhere recently that in Scandinavia somewhere, in one of the populations there, people who are HIV positive and have AIDS now have the same life expectancy as people who don't. The drugs have gotten that good.
Indeed. And there are consistently new ones being developed and new ways of treating these drugs. But taking that out of it, Michael goes through quickly some of the problems with treating HIV. So the first one he notes is viral reservoirs. So there can be a bunch of different viral reservoirs. A lot of them, when treating general viral infections, can actually be to do with the fact that humans are not always the only host. So for something like rabies, for instance, humans can get infected, dogs can get infected, bats can get infected. So even if you got rid of all the rabies virus in humans, there would still be a viral reservoir in the natural world. Now, HIV is not like this. As far as we're aware, there is not a natural reservoir, so one could assume that that would make it easy to treat. The viral reservoir that Michael notes is actually within the human body. So while this is, because this is a retrovirus, it doesn't always have to be active, which means that a lot of the antiretroviral drugs aren't constantly fighting the virus because the virus isn't always replicating. So the problem here is that you have to get a drug in sufficient quantities to destroy the virus or to prevent it from replicating in every single cell of the human body. That is an issue and that's a problem, especially when some of these antiretroviral drugs do have significant toxicity of their own.
Yeah, there's also the problem of most drugs, or many drugs, are limited to where they can actually reach in the body. So, for example, most drugs can't cross the brain-blood barrier, so the barrier between the brain and the circulatory system. So even if you got, all of the virus, all the viruses in the, in the body, in the circulatory system, you may have trouble wiping them out from the brain, and vice versa.
Absolutely. And things like liposomes, fat deposits, even detecting viruses in body tissue is
tricky.
Not an easy matter. The second big one, and this is quite generic amongst all viruses, though some are more prone to this than others, is that is this property of mutation. So living viruses, so viruses aren't living, though there's
that's a debatable topic. We're not going to get into that.
They're not the same as all other living organisms. I think they honestly deserve to be put into a class of their own because they're definitely
they're different.
Parasitic. But one of the things that marks them is their rate of mutation. And HIV mutates extremely fast, and this makes it able to adapt to a lot of treatments that we can a lot of the treatments that we can use to treat this disease. For instance, when we first started administering the antiretroviral drugs to HIV patients, they got better. And then they got worse again. And this is because the virus mutated to be immune or resistant to that particular drug. So what we do now is we administer a combination therapy of at least three, I think it is at the moment, different antiretroviral drugs, which makes the chance of a virus becoming immune to all three of them at once or resistant to all three much, much lower. And that's how we've been able to extend the lifespan. But this mutation rate is a property of the HIV virus. And it's not something that we have found an effective way around yet. It's kind of an arms race between us and them, our drugs and the virus's mutation ability. And the final one he notes, though this is by no means comprehensive, is the complexity of drug design and development. So you can't just get a compound from a duck or whatever you want, and then it's the cure for cancer. Now, that kind of sounds obvious when you say it like that. But even if you find something that is possibly a cure, you have to go through all these different trials. It costs about at least $1 billion to get a compound from discovery to actually going through the different human trials and bringing it to market, which is why there's so few of them at the moment. It costs pharmaceutical companies a huge amount to develop all of these drugs, and some of them don't even work. You're going to have failures right the way along
Along the
the
chain.
curve from discovery right the way through to end product. And that's because the human body and any kind of a viral infection, particularly HIV, is complex. And one drug doesn't do the job, like we just said. You need to design multiple, and the multiple drugs have to interact with the virus in multiple different ways. And that way has to be sustainable, but not too sustainable. And there's all these other considerations to go into it, as well as consistently developing new ones.
And of course, always there's the thing that even if people see pharmaceutical companies as giant evil robots, as pharmaceutical companies are staffed by people, and so the chances are that every single scientist working in every single pharmaceutical company in the world thinks that it's okay to let people suffer and die due to HIV and AIDS is fairly unlikely. There's also potentially a lot of money, there's huge money to be made in a vaccine or a cure for this terrible disease too. So he does say, look, let's be careful here of what we assume people are capable of.
Particularly when it comes to science and technologists, my favourite part of this is at the very bottom, he has a footnote on this post, and he notes that in a survey of New Zealand scientists and technologists, the two biggest reasons for becoming one of those two was the search for truth and the desire to improve the human condition. And that, to me, sums it up, right?
Anecdotally, it's something I'm sure you have as well. I've heard over and over and over again from scientists. They're not in it for the big money or the fame. They're in it to try and help a lot of the time.
If you're in science for the big money, then I think you've misunderstood something along the road there.
Yeah, indeed. So a really, really interesting article. Thank you, Michael. It's also nice to see when people go and codify it to this extent. So next time I hear somebody rabbiting on about this, rather than myself going, well, blah, 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 I can just point them to something like this, which is great. And so with that, we'll start wrapping up. Firstly, a reminder to everyone just to check out the Cyblogs events calendar at cyblogs.co.nz/events. There is a ton of interesting stuff on this week. There are multiple conferences, for example, the International Congress for Conservation Biology at 2 o'clock on Monday. There are the results of the first International Marine Conservation Think Tank, which will be coming out. There are talks with people about digital security, zero-sum games over whaling, the whole shooting match. It all looks like fascinating stuff. And also, do have a look, and we will link to it out. Relatively recently, just a couple of days ago, is a 1.5 hour interview by Stephen Colbert, the American satirist, I suppose one could call him. He's very, very good. And he is interviewing Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is a superstar, sort of astronomy, cosmology, star physics kind of guy, if one has to put it like that. And in fact, Neil deGrasse Tyson is going to be redoing the very famous series Cosmos, originally filmed with Carl Sagan as the host in the sort of 70s, 80s. So not only are we looking forward to the remake, but I would suggest that everybody just goes and has a listen to Steve talking with Neil about science and the beauty of science and the mystery of it as well.
Yeah. And without further ado, I guess we'll finish up. And by finishing up, we have to say thanks to everyone who makes this podcast possible. So to State Shirt and Rian Xian for our opening and closing themes, respectively, and to Cyblogs and the wonderful Cybloggers for providing us with stories and discussion topics and interesting points of view. Remember, you can subscribe to TOSP, the official Cyblogs podcast, via iTunes. Just follow the links on the associated post that goes along with this podcast. You can also follow or listen to us via YouTube at our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/user/cyblogspodcast. Or you can follow our RSS feed via the Cyblogs website, which is cyblogs.co.nz/TOSP. You can find us and other quality science podcasts at sciencepodcasters.org. If you have any comments or suggestions, please put something on our blog. And if you like us, make sure to write a review and rate the podcast on iTunes, because it helps put us up on the front page. Or share a link to this week's podcast on Twitter or Facebook so that you and your friends and your mum and your dad and your sister and your cat can find us too. You can follow Cyblogs posts by subscribing to emails, Twitter or RSS, or just by visiting the main Cyblogs homepage, cyblogs.co.nz. And you can help support the site by getting Cyblogs apparel, thanks to our lovely Amy, by going to www.zazzle.com/AimeeW. And you can follow Amy and myself via Twitter, TH_AIMEE, or Kaiwata, KAIWHATA, respectively, or via our respective Cyblogs. Other than that, from us and all of the Cybloggers at Cyblogs, we think you should stay curious.
See you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.